The church is the one that is present at birth and present at death and present at unemployment. The church is the one that has the capacity to be present at every stage and event in the lives of people within a community.
Hi, I'm Carl Vaders, and welcome to The Church Lobby, Conversations on Faith and Ministry. My guests in this episode are Dr. Shanti Feldhahn and Dr. James Sells, and we'll be talking about what to do when hurting people come to church, as they do every week. It turns out that healthy churches, and as they'll talk about, especially smaller healthy churches, are uniquely situated to alleviate those needs in healthy, life-giving ways, even if your church can't afford the time, money, or personnel, or you think you can't afford the time, money, or personnel, you can still serve people well in these areas. Our conversation will focus on the care strategy, coordinated attention, restoration, and encouragement, and how churches of any size can get equipped to help when hurting people show up, starting with renewing friendships, training a care coordinator, and more. This is all based on the content of their wonderful new book, When Hurting People Come to Church, How People of Faith Can Help Solve the Mental Health Crisis, which I actually named as one of my top books of the year for 2025. And don't forget to stick around when the interview is done. I'll come back with my short take on some lessons that I learned about caring for people based on the time that I spent as a police chaplain. Well, welcome to the Church Lobby. It's good to have you here. Shanti and Jim, welcome so much. Thank you for your time today.
So good to be here.
Great to be here.
Well, the two of you have written a book that I put on my list of my top 10 reads for 2025, When Hurting People Come to Church, How People of Faith Can Help Solve the Mental Health Crisis. So first of all, thank you for writing such a wonderful book.
That's an honor for you to say that and to put us on the list.
Oh my gosh, I'm thrilled. Thank you.
Yeah. Now, in our pre-conversation, we did talk about you both have your doctorates. So I asked if I referred to you originally as Dr. Feldhahn and Dr. Sells, and you both bristled at that. Like, no, just go with Jim and Shanti. But Shanti, you are very recently a doctor. So congratulations on that.
Thank you. This is a brand new thing. I'm still getting used to it.
Yeah, just past December. So I'm going to refer to you at least this one time. Congratulations and thank you, Dr. Feldhahn, for being on the show with us today.
Yes. I appreciate that. Wouldn't have been able to do it without Jim's help.
Oh, I'm really honored that you're taking your time out to be with us. To be able to have both of the authors of this wonderful book on together is a real blessing for me and for my listeners. What I want to do is I want to walk through some of the real highlights of the book for me. But what I want to start with is your book starts with and comes back to a really helpful illustration that everything rests on. It's built on two pyramids. For pastors, especially because my audience is primarily small church pastors, so when they hear about having a helping ministry, helping people who are having emotional problems with their church, it's just like, I can't hire somebody to run a mental health department in my church for me. I don't have time to even sit down and talk to everybody. But when people see these two pyramids, it was really helpful to me to understand, okay, this is something that can be done. And in fact, that the church is really well equipped to do if we look at it through the proper lens. So without having the physical, because this is just an audio podcast, but without having the physical, can you describe for me and my listeners these two pyramids and how it helps us to understand how even a small church can have a healthy ministry helping those through emotional difficulties?
Sure. Shanti, I take the first pyramid, you take the second one. How about that?
Great. Sounds good.
So think about people in the world. The top of the pyramid, the top of the triangle, 8% of the population has serious mental illness. These are the people who have bipolar disease, major depression. Life is really obstructed because of this condition. It is medical, it is psychological, it is social, it is a combination of a lot of factors that make it very difficult for them to hold a job, to be able to maintain relationship, to be able to think creatively. They are overwhelmed. And it is not just pull yourself up and make yourself do it. There's a sense of powerless here. It's a bigger beast than they can manage. The middle part of the triangle are people who have had history with mental health intervention, Maybe they're on medication. They've had a diagnosis previously. They're functioning pretty well. Maybe they have addressed addiction and they are in a support, a help in an AA or a Celebrate Recovery or a regeneration program. And they are doing pretty well. This is about 30% of the population. Now you have the remaining 60%. These are people who have pain. They don't necessarily know major depressive disorder, but they sure know sadness. They know grief. They know discouragement. They know stress. It's not an anxiety disorder, but life is difficult for this person. Maybe they are a single parent with three kids with limited budget. Life is hard. Nobody gets a pass on that. Everybody, life is hard. And so all of these at the top, the middle and the bottom of the triangle get funneled to, hand off to Shanti now. Go ahead.
So think of these two triangles as being side by side. And the left-hand one that Jim just described is the need that every pastor is aware of, because these are the people that come to him, right? But think of, there's also a resource. There's the church. And that's the second triangle. And it's also divided into three layers. And the top of that triangle, as you go higher, you go into more specialization and more authority. So the top of that triangle, obviously, is the pastor. And by extension, a mental health professional that he might refer people to, right? The next level down, you might call these trained helpers. These are folks who have some type of training in some area that could be helpful to people. So it could be that someone's been trained in recovery ministry, like Jim was talking about. Or maybe you have a trained marriage mentor who's gone through some working with some sort of ministry or whatever. And then the next level down is everybody else. And these are just caring Christians. These are lay listeners. These are folks who, when you have grief in your life, if you automatically know that this one person, you want to call them to have coffee because you know that they'll listen. And what we see today, we did a big study of more than 2,000 pastors and other church leaders in order to find out what does their life look like around these needs that keep coming in the door and what are they doing about it. And what we found today is that the vast majority of that left-hand triangle, basically everything in that left-hand triangle, gets funneled up to the top of the other triangle, gets funneled to the pastor and the clinician, which is great. Like, that's wonderful. Most pastors, like if you have an audience that's primarily more small church pastors, many of them became pastors because they have a shepherd's heart. They care for people. And yet, my husband, Jeff, and I were just speaking at a church in Ohio a couple of weeks ago. We do marriage events, and we were getting ready to do this marriage event there. And the pastor, it was probably a 300-member church, something like that. And he said he gets 3, 4, 5 calls a day from people needing help with whatever. And he just can't see everybody.
No.
And so what we're suggesting is that maybe there is a way that we can, instead of referring everything to the pastor and the clinician who have long waiting lists, don't have time, maybe instead we can coordinate more by layers. Because that person who's at the top of the need pyramid, they need the help of a clinician. They need the help of the pastor. But maybe the middle level of the need pyramid could be referred to the trained helpers who are really good at walking alongside specific issues. And maybe the bottom of the need pyramid, the people with pain, you know, your mother died, of course you're sad. Maybe you just need someone to listen. You don't need the help of the clinician. And so it's just a different way of thinking about it. But if you think about it, if we were to put this back into place, this is what the church was for 2,000 years until pretty recently.
Yeah. Everything you've just described, the two of you, is on page 16. So I'm barely into the book. I get to that page. I see these two pyramids side by side and a light went on and I went, oh, okay. I'm going to keep reading because somebody is identifying in a very practical way what every pastor faces. And the simple two side by side pyramids is so helpful because, again, picture in your head these two pyramids side by side. On the left are different levels of needs. On the right are different levels of helpers. And usually everybody in the triangle on the left is referred to the top of the pyramid, the pastor, who then tries to find somebody in severe issues, might refer to a Christian counselor or something like that.
Yeah.
But what if the people with a middle group of needs was referred to people who had some training? They're not clinicians. They don't have the doctorate. They don't even have the pastoral counseling, but they're trained in how to listen and how to take care of people. And then what if you simply had a better connection of friendships on the bottom? And that's something you talk about a lot in the book. We don't have friends as automatically as we used to have friends. And I think that's one of the reasons why so many typical pains that most of us experience are referred to pastors now, instead of sitting and hanging around with friends and finding out a way through this because friends are helping friends. The church should be the leading place in our communities where friends connect with friends in a way that is healthy and life-giving for the pains that we all experience on a daily basis. And as you mentioned, Jim, that's over 60% of the pyramid is people who are in that segment of it, right?
Yes. And those people in the other 40%, the top and the middle, they still need the friends from the bottom of the triangle. In other words, we like to use the phrase in the book, you'll find, we do not refer out, we refer with. So we refer someone with maybe major depressive disorder to a licensed clinician and suggest that the church walk alongside that person as well. So the church retains a presence, a relational presence of friendship, along with these 10 sessions that the person might have with a clinician. The church is the one that is present at birth and present at death and present at unemployment and present during a cancer diagnosis. Therapists aren't there. The church is the one that has the capacity to be present at every stage and event in the lives of people within a community.
One of the things that this registered so deeply with me on is anybody who's been listening to me or reading what I've been writing recently, I've redoubled my emphasis on discipleship.
Yes.
Yeah.
In my book, Desizing the Church, there's a chapter entitled Discipleship Fixes Everything.
I love that. That's awesome.
Yeah. I literally looked at the problems of the church and I could not come up with a problem a church has that discipleship won't fix, because it's what Jesus told us to do. Go and make disciples. He said, I'll build my church, you go make disciples. And if we make disciples, it literally fixes everything. And this is one aspect of discipleship. That is, there are people in our church, one who can simply connect as friends to friends. And then there's another group within that who have the time, the ability, the passion to be able to be trained at a level where they can be discipled and become caregivers. And you, we'll walk through some of the details of that in a little bit. But people who, through the discipleship of the local church, can learn to be better listeners and better caregivers than we just simply are naturally on our own, to be able to care for those whose problems go a little bit deeper and who maybe even, and maybe nothing, who also have the ability to know, hey, this is a little bit above my pay grade. This is something that should be referred to the pastor. So not everything, but they can actually be part of the triage, the emotional and mental triage that helps us know what we do need to have more help with.
Yes.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I really like this because it does begin, you even put it in page 22, I'm going to quote you back to yourselves. The bottom line is that people need friends, real friends, not paid professional friends, not just online friends, as helpful as they can be at times. We need real people who engage in real time over real concerns. And this is, of course, the strength, the superpower of the healthy small church, which is where most of my audience is. So the friendships that we have, or at least should have, is where all of this starts.
Yeah.
Yep.
From this, you introduce something called the CARE strategy, and CARE is an acronym. So if you can walk us through, what is CARE the acronym for, and describe for us how this can help us in our understanding of helping people with emotional challenges and that we can offer emotional and mental health care for.
So CARE, it stands for Coordinated Attention, Restoration, and Encouragement. And it's basically a fancy way of saying, think of those two triangles side by side with the care given by levels, coordinated. Mm-hmm. It essentially also needs someone sitting in the middle. And we call that person the care coordinator. You can call it anything you want. And this is basically what we saw like I said, Jim and I spent 2 years interviewing and surveying these 2,000 pastors to find out, what are you already doing? What are you needing? What are your perspectives on this? What are the heartaches? And one of the things that we found is that when a church was already doing this pretty well, and there are thousands of churches out there of every size that are already doing this pretty well, mm-hmm. we wanted to see what were the common denominators, like what was making it work well. And one of the things that we saw every time was that they had a coordinator of some kind who was sitting in the middle and going, okay, I am going to be the one that takes the calls. When someone calls the church office in pain because their spouse just lost their job and they're in tears and they want to talk to the pastor, the receptionist, instead of saying, absolutely, let me refer you to the pastor's assistant, will say, well, you know, first, absolutely, we may get you to the pastor, but let me have Bonnie call you. And Bonnie's our care coordinator, and she's going to hear your story. And you know what? It may be a couple weeks before we can get you into the pastor, but we can connect you with someone who can walk alongside you right now. And maybe that care coordinator happens to know that one of the listeners, they had gone through a season of job loss and they know how to walk alongside somebody in that situation. And so that's what we mean by that coordinated attention. And mm-hmm. restoration and encouragement is just because we're not talking about diagnosed mental health treatment, right? That often does need a clinician. But we are talking about what is it that we can attend to as fellow believers, as you said, in discipleship. And so that's the whole model is okay. Let's find somebody to coordinate that, with the one caveat that especially in the small church, it cannot be the senior pastor. It cannot be the person who is also doing 1,200 things every day to make the church run. This is usually someone that the pastor knows either has a passion or ability towards this. Like maybe it's a local counselor that they can enlist for a couple hours a week of volunteer work, or it's somebody who they say, I don't know who this is going to be, but I'm going to stand up on stage and say, I want to do this. Come to an interest meeting next Thursday night if you want to be a part of this ministry and see if someone shows up who might be a good person to coordinate. That we've seen over and over and over work really, really well.
Yeah. Yeah. Even to extend it beyond the CARE acronym, that connotes program, to which we, you know, we have an initiative, we have a program, we have resources, we have training, we have all those things are available. Recently, a church latched onto the idea in the Central Plains of the U.S., a church of 80 people. The pastor said, we don't want just a few people designated as the caregivers. We want everybody. So the first training consisted of the first 30 people to sign up. So 3 out of 8 members of their church have gone through the listener skill training, not so they can care for the few, but for that they can reciprocally care for one another. I think the small church is in a unique position, more so than the big mega church, to carry the idea that we love each other really well. We are present for one another. That's why people prefer to go to a small community of believers to be known and to know. Yeah. And the essence of what we're trying to do is say there's an order and there is a skill set that can come along with the effort, the desire to be known and to know and learn to do it well.
As I'm hearing this, because often what I talk about are the differences between big and small churches. There's nothing wrong with any size church, but there are differences between them that we need to understand. And in this particular area of ministry, I think the tendency is that in the big church, there's an expertise on the top of the pyramid.
Correct.
But there may not be as much emphasis as there should be on the friendships on the bottom of the pyramid. Mm-hmm. And so pastors of healthy, large churches know this, which is why they're often pushing people towards small groups and so on, because it's very easy to be anonymous and passive in a big church. And so the healthy pastor of a healthy big church is pushing them towards the bottom of the pyramid, because that's the place where you can get have the least amount of attention paid in a big church. Small church is the opposite. You've often got a lot going on the bottom of the pyramid, all kinds of friendships within the body, but they feel ill-equipped for the more difficult things at the top of the pyramid. And your book, one of the things that I loved about it was, as you said already, you've done these surveys of so many churches. And when you read the book, it feels like this is coming from the results of talking to boots on the ground pastors.
Yeah.
Of all these size churches facing all of these challenges.
Right. To break down the demographics of our survey of 2000, we had 37 pastors of churches of 10,000 or more. So we had some mega churches, like really, really big church pastors there. We had 650 pastors of 100 or less. The largest number of churches dispersed throughout the country, our data was drawn from folks that worship in small communities.
Well, that's great to hear, because that really is very, very close to the balance of big to small churches that exist in our culture.
Yeah, right.
Which is why it felt realistic to me as I read through it. I've had, you know, I'm not going to mention the ministry, but there's a really good ministry out there that puts out these regular reports about the state of the church. And when I go even just a paragraph into their stats, I find out that it's almost, one of the surveys was the average size church was over 900 people. And I'm like, that's not an indication of the church in America. That's an indication of the big church in America. But label it that. That's fine. That's good information to know. But yours really does come from the whole wide variety, which is something to really appreciate about.
And we worked really hard to get that. I mean, we made it a point to, we're going to go to all streams of the church. We're going to go to Catholic and Protestant, black and white, big and small, like every conceivable demographic, every area of the country. And it was fascinating to hear some of the same things over and over and over again about the needs and the concerns. And one of them, Carl, that is interesting that you said that like everything can be solved with discipleship. Because one of the, I think, opportunities here is for pastors to see that addressing these life needs, the pain, the mental health issues, the marriage issues, having some sort of a basic training for listeners at a very basic lay level, that is discipleship, as opposed to what we heard pretty often was, oh gosh, when in doubt, refer out, because I'm not trained. I'm not a specialist in trauma. I don't know how to handle addiction. So I'm going to refer out, which is great. We're fans of that. Jim has been a clinical psychologist for 35 years or whatever, training other Christian psychologists. But there is an opportunity here to see this as no, actually building this within the body, whatever it looks like, because every church is going to have its own DNA, and building those friendships, that is discipleship.
Yeah.
That isn't, hey, we need to focus on discipleship and evangelism and we'll refer the psychological stuff out. It's all together.
Yeah.
And even something as simple as the pyramid, the weight of this rests on the shoulders of everyday disciples, not resting on the shoulders of the experts.
Right.
That just the physicality of the pyramid shows me that, which I really love. But in addition to this, in addition to all the work you did, you didn't just do the work and then walk away. But you spent some time in the book talking about that you followed up 6 months later with the churches who started on this kind of a program.
Yeah.
And you found that there were four key lessons from them. So I'm going to read each lesson to you. And then if you can just amplify on it for our listeners, that'd be really helpful. So
absolutely.
Going back 6 months later to churches that started doing this, lesson number one was this: don't go it alone. Tap the leaders who are called. What's that about?
Mm-hmm. Pastors have a tendency to take this on as their next ministry. Like, no, utilize the people within your congregation and utilize colleagues within neighboring brother and sister churches to collaborate around how we are going to care for not only our churches, but our community in an evangelistic way, so that that person that is called to do this, and there are, in every church, there are people who have been touched by suicide of a child, of an adolescent. There are people who have had a cancer diagnosis and now are in remission. There are people who have lost their house to foreclosure. there are people who know deep, deep suffering all the way down to being emotionally broken and now been built back together. These folks have stories to tell and love to sit with other people, but they don't know how. They haven't been organized, utilizing those passions to build out these ministries, not the pastor like coordinating themselves. This is like identifying the right people and just letting them fly. Because once they're empowered and once they're resourced with, okay, here's the coordinated way of doing it, then they can build it. And it doesn't have to be the pastor who carries the burden of it to make it, along with everything else, happen.
Yeah, that's really important for pastors, especially to understand. This is not adding a burden to your load. Yeah. This is removing one from it by coordinating it and by discipling your own people to care for each other and for others who come in. I used the expression earlier, triage, which may not be a familiar term to a lot of our listeners, but triage, my understanding, was created by medical professionals in war zones when you'd have a whole bunch of wounded come in. You had to decide immediately who gets first treatment, who can wait for a little while because their wound isn't as bad. And there's a triaging that can happen for emotional and spiritual and mental care within the church as well. And again, the healthier the church is and the more we're coordinated with this, the more helpful the triage can actually be.
Yeah. And we are not advocating the undermining of the mental health profession. That's what I do. I train psychologists, I train licensed counselors, and I want them to occupy a space in the beautiful profession of human care. I love doing it.
Yeah.
But I also love empowering the church to attend to the needs of people that I am not capable of attending to as a clinician with my ethical boundaries. I am not allowed to go visit people in the hospital or visit people at home and bring flowers and say, can we just sit and pray? Yeah. And I'm so sorry for the loss of your child. Come into my office and we'll have 15 minutes and define that with a CPT code, a DSM-5 diagnosis, and bill insurance. But I want you as the church to be the one that does the living and the dying in the community. I'm going to help with crisis and empower you to do all the things that you can do much better than I can.
Yeah. And my guess, Jim, is that in your position, because it's similar, it was in my position as a pastor as well. Often we'd sit with somebody and go, you may not say this to them, but you may be thinking in the back of your mind, you're paying me to do what a friend should do. You should just be sitting with a friend right now. That's where this really, and because they can follow up, as you said, in ways that you cannot because of the ethical boundaries that you have, and appropriately so, upon you as a professional. So lesson one, don't go it alone. Let's get to lesson. Lesson two then you came back with was some sort of working group is essential.
Yeah, we found that this was a pretty important linchpin. There were several, as you pointed out, but all the churches that did this successfully had something like a working group, especially if they were starting from scratch. And what that basically meant was something I mentioned earlier. Often a pastor or a senior leader in the church would stand up on stage and say, look, we have seen these needs in our congregation, just like everywhere else, and the needs in the community. We want to be able to meet them. You know, we're not going to be doing clinical work, but we want to be able to be the church and share the hope of Jesus. And right now, we're not set up for that. We don't have an infrastructure. So we want to build one. And if you want to join us, if this is an area of passion for you, if you think maybe you'd be interested in helping guide this, maybe you'd be interested in being a listener, come to our interest meeting in a couple of weeks and see who shows up. And one of the things that we heard from people was this really encouraging movement where there were plenty of people in every one of these churches that had been kind of on the sidelines, but this felt like something that they could do. And this felt like something that they were interested in. For example, and I'll tell you something my husband actually said when we were talking about this, because we're starting this at our own church. He said, I grew up, I came to Christ in the late great planet Earth days, right? Like all the churches were talking about Jesus is coming back, so you better be out on the street corners with the tracts. And he's like, that is so not me. And he said, and yet now we're talking about this need that is overwhelming the church. And you're saying that people who need the hope of Jesus might come to me, might come into the church. Looking for that hope? Absolutely. There is so much more of a feeling of permission, like I'm able to help somebody who's looking for it and share the love of Jesus at the same time. And so that really gets a certain type of person, which is probably the type of person you want to start with.
Yeah. So even in a smaller church, there's going to be a working group available. Is that what you found?
Oh, absolutely. Now, one of the things we actually found just as a sidebar that I thought was fantastic was several of the smallest churches that we talked to talked about coordinating with other small churches. And one of the reasons for that, especially in the small churches, was that if they put together like a joint working group, like, hey, we have these four churches in our, area of, as one real example, the, farmlands of Oklahoma, was talking to this one pastor of a 100-member church in rural Oklahoma, and they were putting together, I think, four or five, I can't remember exactly, but some number like that. And one of the reasons that they were working together was to have listeners at the other churches that, hey, when you've got a small church and kind of everybody knows everybody else, and everybody, as he said, it is in everybody else's business, and you're related to like a bunch of the people in the church, you may not want to have like the lay listener in that church be your person. And so you could go to the church a couple miles
Yeah.
down the way and have a lay listener there that can walk alongside you, help you work through a couple things. And I thought, yeah, great. Like that's the kind of stuff we heard that just everybody did it differently. But this, the key was they were doing it purposefully.
So the working group is essential, and there are creative ways to have the working group come about. Which leads to lesson number three. The working group needs a leader and diverse members, and I'm assuming that leader should not be the pastor.
Right. Typically, that leader is someone with a mental health background. Oftentimes, in larger churches, they have a care pastor. They're designated, and that's their role. They might have a license, or they might have a master's degree in biblical counseling or something like that, and they can easily become the coordinator. But that's only in 20% of the churches. The 80% of the churches don't have those resources. They have someone who can distinguish between what is generalized anxiety disorder and what is stress, and help make those triage decisions and make subtle recommendations, gentle but firm recommendations about we are with you and we see for your benefit the need for additional support that we want to recommend with you. We don't abandon you, we stay with you through it all. But we think that there is greater pain than we can manage just at the lay level. Somebody has to be able to make that call, and that usually requires someone with a background. And this is often just a volunteer. I've done it at my church. A pastor would frequently call me and say, "Help me understand the nature of this person's need because I want to find the right spot for her or for him." Somebody we include in our resources some very basic assessment tools that are utilized by the common person. You don't have to be a clinician. It's not like a personality assessment that requires a level of expertise. No, it's a simple survey about level of symptomology and level of threat that anybody can use to help make decisions about where we should go and what we should do with a person.
Right. So you're talking about someone who's got some wisdom, some life experience, and trustworthiness
Yes.
as a basic starting point. We're not talking about a person who has an extremely high level of education necessarily, although if they do, that's fine. But those are the you were looking about those other things. And now a short break to talk about something else. If you like the content you're hearing, here are two things you can do for us. First, forward this podcast to a friend. Second, consider becoming a financial supporter through Patreon, Venmo, or PayPal. Just go to carlvaders.com/support. For as little as $3 a month, you can help us put these resources into the hands of the ministries that need them the most. Our support link is in the show notes. That's the leader part of this, but you also say the working group needs diverse members.
Yes. So we want to draw from the full community of the church. So it is not for an age group. It is not for a male or a female group. We've got to think how we can creatively attend to the full community of our worshiping body and also the community that we live in. So to think of, it is more common for women to be responsive to this ministry than men.
Right.
So we have to think strategically then about how men will be engaged in their own help-seeking relational formation. How do men get those needs met? By and large, they get those needs met through common activity that then allows for conversation to emerge out of the activity.
Yeah.
Whereas it's more common for women to engage face-to-face, sitting across your room, sitting across from one another at 4 or 5 feet and talking, bearing our soul. That's not a common male experience. So we have to be able to think of this is for everybody, not just for the ones that are easily responsive.
Yeah, and we all obviously know exceptions to all of these rules, but typically, exactly, as the saying goes, women, as you said, do things face-to-face, guys do things shoulder-to-shoulder. Having both of those representations in the room is helpful. Plus, as you mentioned, so many other things too. I think socioeconomic background, ethnicity, especially something that, especially in a way that represents the population of your congregation and of your community, having all those voices in there is very, very helpful, which leads then to lesson number four. And this is one thing that I really loved. It's so many things I love. This is one of the things that I paused and went, oh, somebody's actually addressing this. Before a full rollout, try a pilot phase. You got to know this. For years, as part of my general teaching to small church pastors, I have told them the expiration date is your friend. Anytime you launch a new initiative, put an expiration date on it. If it doesn't work, it didn't fail. It just reached its expiration date. If it does work, then you can continue it. And this idea of a pilot phase, you don't just start it and say, we're going to do this forever now. You do it as a pilot program. You get to work the kinks out. You get to see what works and doesn't work. So talk to us through a little bit what a pilot phase looks like.
Well, it's actually what you just said.
Okay.
It is being able to pull together, for example, that working group under the leadership of a care coordinator and to say, okay, we are going to try this with basic, like some listening training. And, you know, again, we're not talking about the big, like a Stephen ministry that has 52 hours of training. Although if you want to do that, that's awesome. You know, like the listening training that the Church Cares, our initiative created, is 6 hours. And it works as like, you know, the fall Bible study or whatever. You don't have to make it something new and different. It can just be whatever your church already has. But now you have this new way of looking at things that is different than maybe what your church has already had. And so let's just do it. Let's see what happens. Let's have a limited group, like you said, for a limited time. And we're going to train 5 people in how to listen. Right. And maybe we'll work with one other church down the way and see how it works. It's actually really interesting that you mentioned in the last couple minutes about the difference between how men and women will seek help and care. Because one of the churches in Iowa, I think, somewhere in the Midwest, I think it was Iowa, fairly small church, I want to say 200, 250 member church, they had done this with a pilot phase and had sort of gone, okay, what's working, what's not working? And they had all women seeking help and no men. Mm. And they're like, we have men who are listeners and what's going on. And so the men who were part of the working group, again, you need a diverse group. The men who were the part of the working group went, huh, I have an idea. And so one guy came up with an exercise challenge group. And so they would get together. He was like, hey, you know, everybody wants to be in better shape. Not everybody is. And he said, so we're going to get together and we're going to do. And there was some program that they kind of borrowed, and I can't remember what they called it. But on Saturday mornings at, I can't remember what time, like 8 a.m., we're going to meet in the church. In the kind of like the fellowship hall when it's cold and outside when it's not cold. And we're going to do this many push-ups and we're going to do this many this and this many that. And we're going to kind of, you know, kind of up our game. And then afterwards, we're all going to go for coffee. And they set it up so that a couple of these trained listeners were part of that group. And suddenly you have men who are like friends with each other and sharing life and getting all the good feels of the exercise. And part of a group that they could have left and not gone to coffee, but most of them did. And suddenly now they're in a position where they feel able to share. So I thought that was brilliant. I thought that was a brilliant idea.
Yeah, it's a wonderfully helpful illustration because I think up until now, for a lot of people, they may have had this idea that it's a sit around a circle, share your feelings group. But for guys, I don't know what it, Jim, what is it about us that we, if it starts with competition, we're in. But it becomes a leverage towards the deeper things, doesn't it?
Yes, it is not true that men feel less than women.
Right.
It is true that men are usually slower in identifying the words that label their feelings.
Yeah.
So activity gives frequently men time to identify what are the words that are attached to their condition and their circumstances. So the intellectual side, men are good arguers. That's utilizing your cerebral cortex, the front of your brain. We can argue something, but the vulnerability side often takes time to identify. It's not nearly as spontaneous. So another idea that came from this study was the idea that churches don't need to think about selecting the few to be the listeners, but just take a Sunday school class. The Berean class that's been studying Galatians. There's 8 people or 12 people in the class, and just say, we're going to develop this skill as part of our discipleship competence. And we are going to become better at being able to sit with other people in life. And there's no agenda. It's not like we're going to go do a ministry with it. It's not like we're going to now set up a lay caregiver appointment schedule and come see me. No, we're just good at sitting with people in pain. And once you're good at it, opportunity emerges because you know what to do with it. Otherwise, if you're not good at it, you tend naturally to avoid those kinds of circumstances. If I'm really good at fixing cars, I'm going to find people who come to me with their cars that are broken because I'm good at it, and I become a natural gravitation towards that particular need.
Yeah. And this may be a stereotype, but stereotypes usually have a basis in reality. In my experience, women are more comfortable starting from a place of need, whereas men need to start from a place of competence.
Confidence. Absolutely, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's so much to cover in this book. One of the things I want to do is we're going to do a little bit of a bonus that we'll record at the end of this. So I want to take this idea of having multiple people on the team. And in chapter 7, you outline 3 key people that every church needs if they want to help hurting people. It's the pastor, the coordinator, and the caregiver. What each of those roles is assigned to do, how they work together. So any pastors who are interested in doing some of this and want a little more further practical help, we're going to do that in the bonus material. You can get any of the bonus material for any of our podcasts in one of 2 ways. One, you can become a financial partner of this ministry by going to carlvaders.com/support. If you do, then you'll get free copies of all of my books. You will also get a weekly newsletter in which is the link to get all of the bonus material for all of our conversations. If you just want the bonus material for these conversations, you can become a subscriber to the free newsletter by going to carlvaders.com/subscribe. Either way, you can get all of the bonus material. And we're going to talk about those 3 key people every church needs to be able to launch a ministry like this. But before we do that, there's so much more that we could cover. We're not a third of the way into the book. But again, one of these things, so many times I'd go, oh, I'm glad they did that. And one of the things I was so glad you did was chapter 5, which is entitled, But What About? in which you address eight common questions that we just know people are going to have about this. And we don't have time to go through all eight of them. And some of them we've addressed already. Like the first one we've really kind of addressed already. How can we launch a mental health ministry when we're already so busy with other priorities? We've talked about a lot of that. But one of the things, again, I really appreciate is you go right into the heart of our ministry of helping small churches thrive. Number two is, what if our church is too small to host this type of ministry? Now, we've already dealt with this a little bit, but since that is the primary audience for this podcast, let's take a moment or two to answer that question. What about the small church that feels like our church is just too small to host a care ministry? What is some advice you can give for the small church pastor out there who love to do something like this, but just doesn't feel like they've got the size adequate to cover it?
For me, the vision for the Church Cares Initiative, this whole project on my side, started with driving by a small church in rural South Carolina. And I saw a sign on the church, on the marquee. It just said, family council available. This was a church you've driven by, 1,000 of them. Brick, white steeple, small parking lot, and a couple of bushes. And a sign that usually said, Sunday school 9:30, worship service at 11, prayer meeting Wednesdays at 7. That's the standard marquee sign, because the worship, that's what we do to attract people to come to see us. This church was saying, we have a different vision. We are going to go to our community, which is a rural farmland community. And the John Deere's were driving by and the pickup trucks, and that's all that drives to buy this country road. Yeah. And they're saying, you got a kid that has an addiction, come here. If your marriage is in crisis, if your spouse had an affair, come here. So the small church, to me, is the place where this is supposed to happen. Because the small church, as its definition is, it's just a group of people who know one another and can share the meaning of the gospel power with one another in relationship over all the details of life that they face daily. So to me, the small church is where this is more easily created rather than the well-resourced church.
If I could just jump in there, sure that there are pastors listening and going, but I need the resources.
I don't know what to do. I got a big church. Absolutely.
I know. And so one of the things that we haven't mentioned, I don't think, just so that everybody knows, so that if you're the pastor of a church and you're like, I would love to, but I don't know how, that's the reason why the Church Cares Initiative that Jim leads, that's why it exists. And we had a wonderful major donor who had gone through these issues with their family, didn't get the help they needed from their church, and said, we want to build this and offer it for free so that the church can step in and actually be the hero in the mental health crisis. And so we've spent the last 2 years taking all of these lessons that we've seen from all these churches that are doing this well, including the small ones, and putting it into what we call the Church Cares Kit. And it's free on our website. So if you go to thechurchcares.com and make sure it's thechurchcares.com and click join us, you'll see where you can get the kit. And it's completely free. It has the listening training. It has things like an intake form. You know, it has the, okay, how do I know when to refer? It has all that kind of stuff in it in order to help you actually implement this.
Yeah, we'll make sure there's a link to that in the show notes as well. The Church Cares Kit through the Church Cares Initiative. I love that illustration of the church just simply putting that on their marquee out front, because everybody knows that I can go to a church on a Sunday morning for a service. So there's nothing wrong with having, in fact, we should have the times out front so that people are aware of that. But the idea of putting something out like that, you may be the only church in town that does that. And it's not because we're competing with others, but now there's an out front opportunity for help that a church is offering that people might not even think to go to the church for, but that in fact, so many churches are actually very adept at doing, lets people know. Again, it's one of the principles that I talk about with small churches is once you figure out what you do well, front load the value, let people know up front, we offer this right away. And if you can let people know you offer this as a congregation, they know you have Sunday services, that's great. They don't know you have this. And when you do and they know about it, it's an opportunity for outreach into the community that we may be shortchanging ourselves of. So this is just one of the, I'm going to go through a couple others. I'm just going to read a couple of them so that people can know what they can get in the book. On the But What About chapter alone, wouldn't it be safer to stick with trained professionals? And you answer that question. And what else have we got here? Is it realistic to create a full service center with licensed professionals, even if we want to? What about those who are interested in that? And here's one really practical one. I'm going to ask you this and ask you to comment on it, because I know my practical pastor friends out there, some of them are asking this question already. If I set up a care center like this, question number 7, what if the church gets sued? That's a valid question that needs to be asked and answered. So help us, for those who are already asking that question in their own minds out loud right now. What if the church gets sued?
On our resources page on our website, you can click on that and scroll down. That a Regent Law professor with a Yale law degree answered that question. He also was the former executive pastor of a large church, so he knows church ministry, he knows the law, and he emphasized with churches, you live your calling. Mm-hmm. So if in your bylaws and in your mission statement, you are including this type of ministry as an outreach to your calling as a church community, you are fully protected. Now, you can be sued by anyone, but in terms of the legalities of meeting your obligations, if you are inside your mission statement, now, if you are practicing outside, then there is a vulnerability that has to be, if you're running a clinical practice with a licensed psychologist, and that person is operating more like a church than a clinical practice utilizing their license, then you have an overlap and some confounding interests. But if you are functioning as a church, and a church that says, we seek to address the emotional, spiritual, physical needs of our community and to attend to the people who come to our door, and then refer to people who are indeed having greater need than our mission statement covers, we are in really, really safe ground.
Okay.
Surprisingly, in our survey of thousands of pastors, this was, Shanti, do you remember the number? It was a really, really small number.
It was low. It shocked me. Absolutely shocked. It was something like 20% of pastors were worried about this. And I think it's because most pastors are entrepreneurial. And they're like, you could get sued because a small group leader says the wrong thing,
yeah.
Right? Like, I mean, you can get sued for anything. And so they've kind of baked it into their assumptions. Yeah. But there's something about mental health work that sometimes feels a little bit different. Yeah. And so even literally, not just in the chapter that you're mentioning, Carl, but in an appendix in the book, we have some actual advice and language yep. from some of these legal experts who say, for example, listen, if you will just put in your bylaws, what we are doing is religious discipleship, not therapy.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Like you put that in, the yep. government can't regulate religious discipleship. And so if someone is sued and if someone says, you know, of course you can get sued for anything, but the court will probably throw it out. Because what you're doing is religious discipleship.
Yeah. Truth in advertising. Label it properly.
Yeah.
And that really helps a whole lot. There's so much more we could cover and we just don't have time for. You've got an entire chapter on listening and as 7 important points of listening. As the book goes along, the last third or so of the book is very practical in so many different ways. So I really encourage people who are interested in this and who want to follow up more, you can start after listening to this podcast by picking up the book, When Hurting People Come to Church, How People of Faith Can Help Solve the Mental Health Crisis. I highly, highly, highly recommend this. And we will be doing the bonus part. We're going to talk about the 3 main roles that need to be fulfilled to be able to launch this kind of initiative in your church. But before we go and we record that and let you go from this main podcast, I've got the lightning round questions for each of you to answer. Okay, here we go. First of all, what are the biggest changes you've seen in your field of ministry in the last few years, and how have you adapted to them?
First is AI is changing the world.
Mm.
And AI is changing the world for good and for bad. And I see the advantage of the church, powerful presence in an electronic technological environment. The longing for people to have human connection is going to become more prominent. So parts of AI scare me. Parts of it is like, God, what a blessing, because we can offer. We, being the body of Jesus Christ on earth, can offer to the community, come here. For me, that's like we are on major tectonic plate shifts and are watching it firsthand and thinking about how we can strategically utilize all the beautiful changes and accommodate all the destruction that comes with the shift.
Yeah, no question about it. Shanti.
It's interesting. I, as a social researcher, I've spent the last, 20 years talking to people and hearing what are the needs and trying to get a sense for what's going on. And the biggest change that I've seen as I've done these interviews over the last, especially the last 4 or 5 years, has really been this emergence of assumption that what I have as part of my distress is a mental health problem. It's like, I don't know how to handle uncertainty. I feel anxious, so therefore I have an anxiety disorder. And some of that is positive because there's much less stigma around seeking help for mental health, that kind of thing, which is great. And yet this sort of pathologizing, to use a big word, of everything also carries with it a sense of helplessness and a sense of, I'm not sure what to do, or I need a therapist and I don't have one. And so when you ask how have I adapted to that, it's actually one of the things that pushed me into this project, candidly, because of seeing the need for the church to step into that space. And as a researcher, it's also one of the reasons I'm doing another project I just finished the research on. I'm in the middle of writing the book for individuals to take responsibility for their own mental health. And like, here's some things that you can do, because if you're in distress, it doesn't necessarily mean that you have a clinical disorder. It could just mean you have life pain, and that's okay. So here are some of the habits of the people who are the most hopeful, the most joyful. It's kind of like what the Apostle Paul said, right? I've learned the secrets of being content in anything. It's like, okay, what are those secrets? And so that's really the reason I did the project, to try to figure that out.
Yeah, wonderful. That's great. Number two, what free resource, like an app or a website, has helped you lately that you'd recommend for small church ministry?
Can we do an advertisement for our free The Church Cares Kit?
Absolutely.
Because honestly, that's one of the biggest things that I think will help any church listening to this.
Sure.
Yeah. We have tried to put together, just by going on and signing up on with your email address, and that's just so we can communicate with our newsletter. There's 100 different documents that we've created, and the videos, the training manuals, everything a church needs, big, small, middle. Spanish, we have a Spanish version that it's also distributed. So all the content that exists on videos is now translated, utilized in Spanish. So we have tried to build out so it's accessible to the world. If there's one thing, it's not free, but the most influential book that I have leaned on in thinking about all this, because we're not just talking about, oh, do this program. We're really talking about a cultural shift in how the church does ministry. So, it's kind of funny. I'm trained as a psychologist and Shanti as a social researcher, but what really becoming is evangelism and discipleship strategists. That's a surprise. Andy Crouch's Culture Making has been a phenomenal book for me to think about how this thing works, how to create culture, create a new culture, which is actually a new product. Creating a new product that fits a need is how you build new culture. So I found that book really helpful in thinking about a different way of doing ministry. So that would be Andy Crouch, Culture Making, published by IVP.
Got it. We'll put links to that in the show notes. And with your permission, I'll put a link to a PDF of those side-by-side pyramids that we've been talking about so people can physically see that.
Oh, that'd be
very, very helpful for them. Yeah.
Yeah.
Third question, what's the best piece of ministry advice you've ever received?
I'll tell you mine early on, and this is something actually that I've now heard from multiple pastors, but when I first started into ministry, it was a bit of a rocket ship because my book sort of unexpectedly became a bestseller, several bestsellers, and I was completely fried. I mean, I wasn't getting any sleep. I had little kids. Like it was pretty hard. And I feel for many of the pastors out there because they're even busier than that usually. And I had a sweet older woman in our congregation who sat me down, saw how exhausted I was, and she said, "You need to find people to help you do the things that you don't have to do to free you up to do the things that only you can do." And it clicked and it really changed everything. And I've heard many pastors who have shifted into a mode of, but I have to do everything, to know I have to find people and empower people to do the things that I don't have to do to free me up to do the things that only I can do.
Yeah, that's huge, Jim.
I have come to appreciate just showing up, and amazing things happen when people get together. I've come to rely on my spontaneity to be much more effective for me than my detailed planning. So that sense of I want to show up and see what God does and allow for the unique traits and characteristics and skills of those who are present to spur one another on. Yeah.
Terrific. All right. From the sublime to the potentially ridiculous. What's the funniest or weirdest thing you've ever seen in church?
So I was speaking at a, sorry, this still just cracks me up. I was speaking at a large multicultural church in California. Pastor's African American, fairly big chunk of the church is African American, Hispanic, etc. And when I came on stage, I could see everybody go, oh, my husband and I were getting ready to do a marriage conference, right? And we knew the pastor well. And when I came on stage, I could see the congregation's eyes get big, and because they all thought that I was black because of my name. So the pastor's like, "This is not who we thought we were getting when we heard that we were having Shantae come." So that has happened more than once, actually, and it always cracks me up.
I can imagine so with the first name for sure. Yeah,
Yeah.
Jim.
I'm allowing my mind go to the absurd. The 6-year-old boy who, after in a traditional church setting, they pass the offering plate and they are about to do communion in maybe a traditional evangelical method of passing around the two trays. And he says out loud, "I paid my 25 cents. Now, where's my juice?"
That's
The answer
awesome.
to that is Jesus paid it all. That's hilarious.
That's awesome.
You got to love what the kids will do for that. Thank you so much for your time today, both Jim and Shanti. And we are going to do about 5 minutes on the three key people the church needs to do this well. So we'll put links in the show notes to how to get all of that bonus material. But thank you. Thank you so much. And your book, I highly recommend it. One of my top books of the year. I'll have a link to my top books of the year article in the show notes as well. When Hurting People Come to Church, How People of Faith Can Help Solve the Mental Health Crisis. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, Carl.
Well, several years ago, I spent some time as a volunteer police chaplain for our city. There were a handful of pastors who served in this capacity, and we learned quite a bit as we served our police and the city. As Drs. Feld, Hahn, and Sells were talking about how average church members can serve the church and take the pressure off the pastor's ministry load by doing so, I was actually reminded of that training. Just like pastors are often called to do work that others could do, police are as well. For example, police officers are often called in as peacekeepers when two spouses or sometimes two roommates have split up and one or both of them doesn't feel safe when it's time to clear out their shared living space. Police are sometimes called to stand outside while they pack up to assure that no one does anything harmful. But this sometimes turns into a counseling situation when someone needs a shoulder to cry on. The police want to help, but they're not nearly as well suited for that kind of work as we are. So many times, someone would see a chaplain badge and would spend a lot of time crying and praying with us. In this way, our skills as a pastor, supplemented by a short amount of training in police procedures, helped the couple, the police, and gave us an opportunity for ministry that we wouldn't have had otherwise. Likewise, the care strategy we've been talking about in this podcast does something similar. It allows church members with just a little training to come alongside and to reach out in ways that the pastor can't to comfort people who need our help. So I strongly encourage you and your church to check out the links provided in the show notes and to see if a care ministry in your church might be a great way to ease the burden from the pastor, to release church members into ministry, and to serve our church and our community better. This episode was produced by Veronica Beaver. It was edited by Phil Vaders. Original theme music was written and performed by Jack Wilkins of jackwilkinsmusic.com. The graphic design is by Solomon Joy. And me, I'm Carl Vaders, and I hope to talk with you again in the church lobby.